the properties of the Higgs. We wrote out the part of the Lagrange unit involving the Higgs. And it also coupled to the W and Z bosons. And we saw that because the Higgs gets a vacuum expectation value that breaks SU2 cross U1 just to the U1 subgroup of electromagnetism, that the W and Z got heavy. And furthermore, that some of the components of what we had in the Higgs field, for example, we had this Higgs doublet field, and you could write it like this. And we found that H plus, it's complex, this is complex, and the imaginary part of this were gauge artifacts. We could remove them by SU2 cross U1 transformations. And one of the problems on your problem set will have you do that explicitly, make the transformations and show how to remove it. So that all seemed great, but there's something about it that makes me a little nervous. So if you have a massless gauge boson, the photon, it has two polarizations, two helicity polarizations. But if you have a massive particle, spin one, it has three polarizations. So all of a sudden, you know, we started off setting up the theory as if it was a little confusing. So remember where this came from. This came from lambda over 4 h dagger h minus v squared over 2 squared in the potential. And really, this is just a parameter here. And so another theory, the pink theory, might have had a plus sign here. And let's imagine v is really small, so small. We're in an imaginary world now. Often physicists go into imaginary worlds. It's sort of pretty scary, actually. You know, if you're not a physicist and you do that, you're considered insane. But we get away with it. Anyways, imagine a world where V was so small it had really negligible impact on all experiments. You wouldn't expect then that, depending on the sign here, that the physics should change dramatically. These arguments actually, sometimes they don't work the way heuristic argument. And sometimes these heuristic arguments don't quite work, but let's follow this reasoning. So the physics shouldn't depend very much on that. In particular, the number of degrees of freedom in the theory shouldn't depend on that. So how many degrees of freedom would there be if this had a plus sign? Well, then I couldn't remove these. So I'd have three additional scalar degrees of freedom, two for the complex one and the imaginary one here. Yet I said it shouldn't affect the physics, it's so small, so the number of degrees of freedom in the theory shouldn't change. But when it was massive, this was gone. And indeed, the number of degrees of freedom does not change. Because if V has the other sign, the Higgs doesn't get a V, the W and Z are massless, and so they have one less polarization. And so the number of degrees of freedom is the same in the theory, whether the Higgs gets a V or not. And Sidney Coleman, a very well-known, great theoretical physicist, passed away, but had a very colorful language for what was going on here. He said, his language, roughly, I don't know if I can remember the exact words, was that the W and Z bosons ate the imaginary, well, the Z eats the imaginary part of this, and the W and the W's eat this, and they become heavy by consuming these quantities. And in fact, those fields go into what you might call the longitudinal polarizations of the W and Z. Okay, so probably should have said that last time, but I forgot to say it. Okay, so far we've talked about the gauge bosons from the gauge group a little bit, the eight colored gluons, three here, one here, and they get massive. We mean the massless photon, the Z, the W plus and minus. We talked about the Higgs. But hey, there's a lot more to the standard model than that. we got to at least get in all the degrees of freedom. So today we're going to get in all the degrees of freedom, all the particles, and we're going to start working out their properties. So usually when you write out the standard model, you write it out in terms of left and right-handed fermionic fields. And one thing it's important is that if you have a left-handed field, if you transform it under Lorentz transformations, then it just mixes up that left-handed field. Here's a Lorentz transformation lambda. And the right-handed ones similarly transform amongst themselves. So there's no reason that the left and right components of a Dirac field have to have the same quantum numbers under the gauge group. It still commutes with Lorentz transformations because they transform separately, just like a scalar could have different quantum numbers than a fermion under some global transformation. So when we write out the standard model, we decompose everything into left and right-handed fields and look at their quantum numbers under the gauge group. So I don't know if you learned this in field theory or not. If not, you'll just have to trust me. It's kind of like going to a car dealership. Just trust me, it'll be okay. Okay, so here's the standard model, the quantum numbers of the fermions. This is it. These are all the fermions. We know about the gauge bosons. We know about the Higgs. This is it. This is the whole standard model. This is actually all you have to know. You got to add the Higgs. It's quantum numbers. What's the first? What else would you think you'd have to know? Ooh. Come on. You're a physicist. You want to calculate a lot of stuff that can be measured. You want to be the first one to calculate so you can become famous. Win the Nobel Prize. Go off to Sweden. We'll all be good. What do you need to calculate stuff? Can you do it from this table? Well, I'm going to claim yes, but it's not. But we have to do some philosophy before that. Yes?
What about the coupling constant
values? Okay, so you need the coupling constant values, and you need the Lagrangian, right? Once you have the Lagrangian, and you know the coupling constants, you could fit them to the data to get their values by predicting things. I'm going to give you this quarter, even though I feel it was only 25% points. But I like to throw the quarters. Ready? Should be playing for the Dodgers. Okay, we need a Lagrangian, right? We need a Lagrangian. That's where the laws of nature come from. That's what, you know, tells you how you calculate the K rates and cross sections. Lagrangian does indeed involve certain parameters, and then you would fit those. But you'd have more things than you can measure by number of parameters. So you'd actually get real predictions. So we need a Lagrangian. I say, no. I don't have to tell it to you, because you can work it out yourself. Once I give you this table, it's Miller time. And then after you have you might choose a different beer, or some other drink, or a Coke, or a Pepsi. But anyways, after that, you can just write out the Lagrangian. Why is that? Well, how do you write out the Lagrangian? You've got the quantum numbers of the field. Our Lagrangian is made of local interactions. It's Lorentz invariant. It's invariant under these gauge symmetries. And we're going to leave out all the operators whose coupling constants have dimensions of mass to an inverse power, because we're going to imagine that mass is very large, and so they have a negligible impact. That leaves us with a finite number of terms in the Lagrangian, each of which has a coupling constant, and we can go ahead and predict. So I don't have to tell you the Lagrangian. You can figure it out from this table. So this table is the theory. You don't need more. And that's the philosophy that we're going to take when we consider the standard model. Look at that, the whole thing. It's like here. Are you impressed? This course over. Of course, that's a little bit like saying general relativity, you know, L is root G R. That's a little bit misleading, but that philosophy is very powerful. It's really very, it's extremely powerful. So let's step through the quantum numbers of the particles, because since this is all we got to know, we got to get comfy with this table. It's a pretty small table. You should copy it down. Take it home when you go home with your parents. Show them the standard model. Show your siblings the standard model. If you're in a bar one evening attempting to get a date, show the person you're talking to the standard model. That'll probably minimize your chances. But anyways, it's very impressive. Okay, let's step through it. There's only a few columns. We got left hand, so we got quarks, capital Q, and this is a doublet under SU2. So this is the upper and lower parts of the doublet. I've called this U and D. There's three copies of this in the standard model. So this index I is sometimes called a flavor index. It goes over 1, 2, 3. It's a color triplet. That's the fundamental representation of SU3. I already told you it's a doublet. What hypercharge does it have? What quantum number should I put here? So remember, Q, I tried to squeeze it there. That's too beautiful for me to squeeze. Q is T3 plus Y. So I want, you already know a little about quarks. I want these to be up-type quarks. What charge do up-type quarks have under electromagnetism? Someone in this class doesn't, there must be someone who knows the charge of an up quark.
Say it louder, guys.
Gotta say it louder.
Two-thirds.
Oh, geez, Louise. You have, so, you know, there were other two-thirds before you, but shouting counts. Okay, who actually said it first? Come on, speak, was back there?
Somewhere back here.
Somewhere back there. Take credit for it. I'm about to offer you a quarter.
I'll take credit for it.
You'll take credit. Okay, that's right. That's the way it's supposed to work. Okay, for shouting. Give me the answer first, or claiming to. Okay, so Q is T3 plus Y. We got to get two-thirds here. So a half plus a six is two-thirds. That's why I put the six here. Similarly for the other ones, we got right-handed quarks. They don't transform under SU2 left. They just have hypercharge and color, and so this has to be their charge. Similarly for the right-handed down quarks, all of these have an index I, a generation index that goes over 1, 2, 3. Then we have the left-handed doublet with the left-handed neutrinos, and the left-handed electron, and similarly we have the right-handed electron. Everything replicated three times. Nobody knows why it's replicated three times. I don't know. Nobody knows. So, yeah?
So, logically, could I have three generations of quarks and, say, four generations of leptons?
Well, there's another condition that you have to talk about, which is anomaly cancellation. So these symmetries are, the gauge symmetry will be a symmetry of the Lagrangian I write down. But then you have to do quantum corrections to that theory. So when you write down the Lagrangian, look at it just as couplings, that's basically classical physics, but then you can have quantum corrections that might spoil the gauge symmetry. And there's a condition called anomaly cancellation, and I don't think it would work because of anomaly cancellation because of that. But that, you know, I have to pick and choose what I talk about in this class, so I wasn't going to talk about anomaly cancellation. Yeah?
I don't understand the argument regarding charge in two-thirds and one-sixth.
So, we have particles we observe in nature. We know their charges. So these are supposed to be, this is supposed to be nature, right? So the up quark we know has charge two-thirds. We don't really see up quarks, but we know the protons are made of them. We scatter electrons off protons, and so indirectly we can measure that charge. So I've already assigned for you an SU2 here, and I know it's a doublet because I know it couples to W's. I'm using experiment. And then I just got to pick the hypercharges 6 here that makes it work out so these have the right charges. So Q is T3 plus Y. So T3, this is the upper T3, which is a half. So a half plus a 6 is 2/3. And minus a half plus a 6 is minus a 3rd. So that's why this is the right hypercharge, to get the right charges for the quarks. Is that clear? Clearer. That was perfection. Any other questions before we go on? Yeah?
If you have a doublet, do both of the elements of the doublet have to have the same hypercharge?
They have the same hypercharge, yes.
But is that
necessary? It commutes with the S. Well, the way we set it up was the group was just a product of them, so it commutes with it. It's just a U1, so it multiplies by, that's what I mean by a U1.
Okay, right.
It's just a phase factor.
To the identity.
Right. So viewing it acting on this column vector, it's proportional to the identity.
Right.
More questions?
So do U, R, and D are not form a doublet?
They are not a doublet.
Oh.
They are just singlets with respect to the SU2. They have color and they have hypercharge. And this is this assignment to doublets, and knowing this has to do with experiment. The fact, you know, what a W boson couples to. So, you know, this assignments come from trying to agree with experiment. Yeah, so it doesn't look so great, right? Oh, yes?
So you mentioned, like, left and right electrons and three generations of them. So, like, in a metal, you see, isn't there one type of electron?
There's one type of electron, but the other ones, the heavier ones, are unstable. So we're made out of the stuff that's stable. And the stuff, you know, the stuff of condensed matter physics is the stuff that's stable. Muons, so the three generations are electron, muon, tau, and the muon and the tau, they decay. We'll calculate that decay rate later on to the lower mass ones. So they only live a very short amount of time, and metals aren't made of it. We're not made of it. Nothing in here is made of it. That's why we need these giant accelerators. So they don't influence everyday life, but, you know, we're trying to understand the laws of nature, whether it influences everyday life or not. So we want to know what the degrees of freedom are in the theory. Yes?
When you're trying to compute the charge, is it T3Y or the linear combination of the equivalent one?
Well, T3 plus Y is a linear combination of T3 and Y.
Got that. I mean, the coefficient is 1 and 1, or?
It's 1T3 plus 1 times 4.
Could you show me how to get the...
Okay, let's do one. So remember what T3 is. T3 sigma 3 over 2, so it's a half. Right? And this is Y times the identity matrix. So now we have this act on the doublet. So for the upper one, I'll get a half plus a 6. And for the lower again, I'll get minus a half plus a 6. And that gives me the charges of those two components of the doublet.
So,
okay?
Yeah, the first component of the charge.
So Q could act on a doublet, so it can have different values on the upper and lower components of the doublet. That's all. So the upper and lower components of a doublet don't have the same charge because T3 has different values acting on
them. Oh, I see. Actually, you can get the 2/3 charge for the upper and the minus 1/3 for
Right. Yeah. Well, you got to understand this. So I'm willing to take questions until everyone is completely satisfied. Wow, you're completely satisfied. That's awesome. You notice anything that looks slightly asymmetric about this? Well, there's the fact that the left and right handeds are treated differently, and people propose extensions of the standard model where they try to make that look symmetric. But look at this. We got a U right, a D right, an E right. What are we missing?
Right-hand.
We're missing new right. Maybe it's there. So I don't know how much I'm going to talk about neutrinos in this class. I could give a lecture on it, but whether there's a new right in the standard model or not is not known. I guess I'll talk a little bit about it maybe towards the end. Yes.
Why do we put the left-handed fields into doublets but not the right-handed?
Ah, that's because of experiment. We look, so the W bosons, they couple to doublets, right? They don't couple to the right-handed singlets because they're in the SU2 group. And we just observed that they couple to the left-handed components of the fields and not the right ones. Experiment. We have to agree with experiment. And it's a nasty thing, unfortunately. You write down the theory, you write down one that looks great, it doesn't have to be the theory, right? It doesn't have to be the one that agrees with experiment. So it might have looked nicer if these were in a doublet and the W's interacted with them, but it wouldn't be nature. We got to agree with Nate. Yeah?
But why should the doublet that interacts with the force consist of an up and a down? Why not ups separately from downs?
Well, a W boson has charge, if you remember. So, you know, let's say we look at the W plus emitted here, and we have a U quark. The thing that comes out, because charge is conserved, it's got to have charge 2/3 minus 1. So it's got to be minus 3. It's got to be a down quark. So just by charge conservation, a W will take it, will couple up type to down type. A Z would couple up to up, for example. Everybody with me so far? No, there's no up doublet.
Sorry.
I mean, there's only an up down doublet.
Well, sorry, what you said about Z bosons, what they couple to?
Well, the Z bosons, they're a linear combination of the hypercharged B and W 3, if you'd like, but W 3 is diagonal. It's W1 and 2, which we then write as W plus and minus for definite charge, that make this transition. So a W plus is like, you know, it coupled to the matrix that, you know, had was like this. It existed in this part of the 2x2 matrix, so it would take it up to a down. Any more questions? Okay. Took a long time, but it's okay. So I told you that this is the Lagrangian, and we're going to have kinetic terms. We know how to write down kinetic terms with covariant derivatives. And we have separate ones for the left and right-handed field, so we already know how to do that. And so I think the next thing we should try to look for are mass terms. And we know the electron's got a mass. We actually know the quarks have a mass, but it won't be till the third week. When you see why. So we got to talk about mass terms. Got to write down some mass terms. Let's see now. So what could be a mass term? Well, you might think I could write down for an up quark, U right bar U right. Let's start with that. It's invariant under Lorentz transformations. It's gauge invariant because it's U bar U, and it's zero. It's the zero operator because this is U bar 1 minus gamma 5 over 2. 1 plus gamma 5 over 2 u, when I take the right out of here and move it in the center. So mass terms of this type, it's color invariant also. You could contract the color indices here. So mass terms have to connect left with right. There is a way to get something left-handed. You can form what's called the conjugate of the field and bar it. But then you can't make a color invariant, you can't make, doesn't have the right hypercharge, because this is like complex conjugation. So if you follow this through, so here's one that looks okay. L bar left E right. It won't be zero. Right? It's got a left-handed fermion field and a right-handed one, so it's not zero, like this one was. What's wrong with this as a mass term? Well, it's cash on the line. Breaking out the roll. It'll take me 20 minutes to unpack the quarters. What is it not invariant under?
Is that a left-handed doublet and a right-handed doublet?
This is a doublet under SU2.
Yeah, this is
a singlet.
Just one.
It's a singlet under SU2.
Yeah.
So what's wrong with it? Finish the sentence. You're on the right track. Is it invariant under SU2?
No.
No. That's the right answer. It's got to be invariant under SU2, right? Our Lagrangian has to have the gauge symmetry.
Oh, yeah.
Can you repeat why it's invariant under
SU2? Well, this is a doublet. And that's all we got is a doublet. A doublet is not an invariant. It's a doublet. To make it invariant, we could combine two doublets and then have an epsilon tensor contracting the doublet indices. That would be an invariant under SU2. So the upshot of all this is that if you stare at this thing and you try to write down all the mass terms you could, there's no mass terms allowed. We can't write out a mass term, something quadratic in the field that's invariant under Lorentz transformations, SU3 in it. SU2 cross U1 invariant. But we do have the Higgs field that gets a vacuum expectation value. And so if we can write down interactions that couple two fermions with a Higgs field that are invariant, then when the Higgs field gets its vacuum expectation value, it could generate masses. So what we've learned so far is that the gauge symmetries of the standard model and the particle assignments forbid possible mass terms. You with me? Okay, so let's write out the allowed couplings to the Higgs, and then when the Higgs gets a vacuum expectation value, we'll see how all the quarks and leptons get mass. Okay. So here I go. So these are called the Yukawa couplings in the standard model, but I like to form, we'll shorten it up, it's L yuck. So each part of the Lagrangian, I give a little name. And so here we go. So it's kind of complicated to write down. Of course, we have to suppress a fraction of the indices of order unity. And I'll tell you what I'm suppressing as I write it out, so you'll completely understand it. So here's the Higgs. And I'm going to contract it with the left-handed doublet here. And then to make a singlet under SU2, I have to put the epsilon tensor. It's the epsilon. That's how you make singlets under SU2. You can either do H dagger Q or H transpose epsilon Q. Those are the two types of ways you can make it invariant in SU2. What do I have at color? So I've suppressed the color indices here and here, but because the bar includes complex conjugation, it's a color singlet when you sum over those colors. Should I put the color indices back in this one time? What do you say, class? Yes or no?
Yes.
Yeah, I was going to do it anyways. But thank you for the yes. They're in pink. These are each doublets contracted with the epsilon. I'm not going to put the doublet indices in. If you want them, I could put them in. But then it gets kind of grungy, kind of a lot of indices everywhere. So it's manifestly invariant. Well, not all. It's immediately obvious to the human eye. Yes?
J index on Q.
Oh, thanks. Oh, now I have to make a decision whether I'm supposed to give you a quarter or not.
Who said that? I just
conveyed the You ready?
Yeah.
Don't drop it. Look at that toss. Oh, oh, somebody's got to get an F. Okay. So, thank you. So, what do we got to check? It's invariant under SU2 because of this. It's invariant under color. So we have to check hypercharge.
Can I ask a question? What do you mean by H an element of Q?
I didn't hear you.
What do you mean by H?
I think it's an element of Q.
Oh, this is the epsilon 2x2 matrix.
Okay, okay.
Yeah, too much math, right? It's okay. Too much math.
What is the significance of
the epsilon is to make an SU2 invariant. If you have two doublets, there's two ways to make, let's say you have doublets A and B. They're both doublets under SU2. There's two ways to make an invariant. A dagger B, or the complex conjugate, or A transpose epsilon B. Either of those makes something that transforms, is invariant under SU2. So that's a little bit of group theory, but it's the group theory of the rotation group, basically. So I'm assuming you've seen that before. Okay, so we got to check that it's invariant under the hypercharge. So let's just add up all the hypercharges of these terms. In purple, I'm into colors now. What do I put here? Well, this is 2/3, but I got the bar, so I put minus 2/3. What is it for the H? Do you remember what it was? 1/2. And what for the Q, it's a 6. Then I add them all up, and what do I get? 0. And so this is an allowed term in the Lagrangian. It's invariant under hypercharge, under SU3, under SU2. And now we can do the other ones that are allowed. There's, of course, whether I put a minus sign in front is a convention, but you'll see why I did it in a moment. The indices I and J, they're these flavor indices. It's summed over I and J. So, I mean, this is some 3x3 matrix of Yukawa coupling constants, a lot of free parameters.
Sorry, what is the GU IJ?
Well, so the U here is just a subscript in the name. I decided to call it that. I had to call it something. I could have called it Mark sub U, upper IJ. U to the note that it's going to give mass to the up quarks. Why is that? Well, when the Higgs gets its vacuum expectation value, it's in the lower component, right? So if I put that in here, then with the epsilon, it'll hit the upper component of this, so I'll get something that looks like U bar right, U left. So this will become a mass term for the up-type quarks.
So G here is like a fitting parameter.
GU is 9 complex numbers that we have to fit to data. 18 real parameters. I give up. That's a lot of parameters already. We're just getting started. Not all of them matter in the end. But, yes?
So by the fact that the L has to be real? The Lagrangian, does that...
Oh, shoot. Yeah, well, when we get to the end, we're going to say plus Hermitian conjugate. But we haven't got to the end yet. Yeah, we have to make it Hermitian. Absolutely. Any other questions or comments?
So technically, G is just one big matrix. So GU there and GU.
G can be viewed as a 3x3 matrix of complex numbers, and those values have to be fit to data.
Yeah, sorry, I mean to ask. So GU is essentially the same as GD that you write there.
This is going to be another independent 3x3.
Yeah,
I have to keep it going. There's going to be a lot of parameters. You're getting to like the standard model less and less, aren't you? Yeah. Don't fear. So hang in there. It's not as bad as it looks. Here we go. So in this case, if I want to check the hypercharges to see if it Sorry, this doesn't look like a very good R, does it? Oh, I got it twice, no wonder. Hold on, let me fix this up. I was hallucinating. Well, you know, you can also check that the hyperchargers work in this case. And let me write the last one, because we're going kind of slow. And then plus Hermitian conjugate. So what we've got here are three separate 3x3 matrices. The entries are all complex numbers. And those parameters are just parameters in the standard model that have to be fit to the data. All of these terms are SU3 cross SU2 cross U1 invariant. They're the only ones we can write down. There aren't any more possible terms. Yes?
Are there epsilon in the second?
Pardon? No epsilon. This is the other way to make an SU2 invariant with the dagger. And why was that? Well, it has to do with making the hyperchargers add to zero. Yeah, but remember, if I put H dagger here, when I add up the hyperchargers, it's minus a half.
Yeah.
So it won't work. This one won't work unless I use the dagger. Right? The hyperchargers have to add up to zero. So I'm forced to the dagger here by the hyperchargers, as I'm forced to the dagger there. Everybody got it so far? Okay. So,
you said SU3 cross SU2 cross U1. So, would you show me why is SU3?
Okay, so let's put back the color indices. This color index goes over 1, 2, 3. It's a triplet under SU3. And, you know, if I have psi alpha star psi alpha, where this is an SU3 index, and I make an SU3 transformation. So I'll just write this at psi dagger psi. It goes to U, where this is an SU3, psi dagger U psi, which is psi dagger U dagger U psi, and this SU3 transformations are unitary, so it's invariant. So the fact that it has the structure dagger not dagger, indices contracted, makes it invariant under SU3. That's why we picked that structure.
Okay, so for example, for the third term, that is E, R, I, bar, and L.
This is E, R, I, L, I, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
L, J, sorry. And this should be J. Sorry. Summed over I and J.
Okay.
Okay? Everybody got it? So now we're going to put in the Higgs vacuum expectation value.
Does the hypercharge have to be zero for each term?
For each term. It has to add up to zero for it to be invariant under the U1Y gauge symmetry. So what do these interactions do? Well, I could put in what the Higgs field is. What the Higgs doublet is, sorry. It's 0 V plus H over root 2. So these terms in the Lagrangian give you, when I put V in, they give us mass terms for the quarks and leptons. And when I put H in, they give the Higgs couplings to the quarks and leptons. Okay, so let's proceed a little further with this. Okay, let's proceed a little further. So what I want to do is put in the expectation value. So we'll do all of it later. So I'll just take the Higgs field there, the doublet field there, and I'll set this part to zero, and we'll just look at what comes from V. We're trying to get all the physics separately. So what comes from V are what we call mass terms. And now I'm going to write it in a matrix notation. Instead of putting the I and J indices explicitly, I could move this between them and then leave off the indices, so it's the usual matrix way of writing things, and I get minus UR, some 3x3 matrix that I'll call MU, U right, minus DR bar MD, D left, minus E right, bar ME E left, and then plus the Hermitian conjugate. So these are mass terms, and these 3x3 matrices, what are they? Well, MU is equal to GU as a matrix, V over root 2. MD is equal to GD, V over root 2. And ME is equal to GE, V over root 2. So these are 3x3 mass matrices. They're not diagonal matrices. They're not diagonal. So we don't know what particle is the electron. The electron has a definite mass. It's what we call a mass eigenstate of the mass matrix. We don't know which one is the muon. We have to diagonalize these matrices to go to the mass eigenstate basis to find out what the particles are in terms of the fields we've introduced to start with in the theory. So the electron will not be E1. It'll be some linear combination of E1, E2, E3 that we get by diagonalizing these matrices. You got that? Well, so we want to diagonalize the matrices because we want to know what the electron is. What type of transformations should we use to diagonalize the matrix? Well, let's look at the kinetic terms. This time we'll be a little more explicit. Okay, I got room. Let's look at the kinetic terms. Well, let's leave out the couplings to the gauge bosons for the moment. Just look at the derivative, because we're after the dispersion relation. Those other terms are interactions. We'll talk about them later. So we got things like this. And this goes down to U left bar I D slash U left I plus D left I D slash D left I. And similarly, we got things involving the lepton doublet and the right-handed fields. Okay, so let's say I'm going to diagonalize the down type mass matrix.
Does that arrow denote the quality?
What arrow? Oh, yeah, okay. Well, I guess it's a quality in this case. So, and then we also have other terms, of course, like we have U bar right I D slash U right I plus D right I D slash D right I plus the leptons. So, and when I write it in terms of mass eigenstates, I want it to have the same form, right? Because if I mess up the kinetic terms, if they coupled electron to muon, I still wouldn't know what an electron was. Both the kinetic term and the mass term have to end up diagonal for us to interpret what the particles are in terms of the field. So how do I do that? Well, what type of transformation would leave this invariant? Well, clearly any unitary transformation amongst these three fields, mixing them up, because I would get U dagger here and U here, a global SU3 transformation would leave the kinetic terms invariant. So we want to try to diagonalize the mass matrices using unitary transformation. Yes?
So this SU3 has something to do with
color. Nothing to do with color. This is an SU3 transformation. It's not gauged. It's global, so I moved it right through the derivative. And it's on flavor space, on the index I's, which goes over 1, 2, 3. That's where it's acting. Don't ask me why I doesn't go over 1, 2, 3, 4. Nature doesn't have them. And that's all I know about that story. Yes? This is just for the quarks. And I've added, so this line went to this, and then, so on this side, I guess, should be. But a similar story holds for the leptons, of course. Yes?
What if you had actually four families of quarks and the related ones were very heavy? Would it matter? Would you be able to see it?
We can't make them very heavy, as you'll see in a moment. First of all, their mass comes from coupling to the Higgs, and the vem of the Higgs has a fixed value. So without going to strong coupling, we couldn't increase that. And even if you go to strong coupling, it still doesn't really increase. you can't make the coupling constant bigger than a certain value. So we can't make them arbitrarily heavy, and it ends up the neutrinos are always light, so. Okay, so we got to make unitary transformations. So let me write them the following way. So I'm going to introduce, let's talk about the up quark. We'll talk about up quarks, because everything is the same for the other cases. So we're going to take U left, that field, and write it as some 3x3 unitary matrix that I denoted in this. So this is a 3x3. What are we doing time-wise? Okay. Different 3x3. And these ones are supposed to be the fields that are the mass eigenstate fields, the one for which the mass matrix is diagonal. And so U right dagger, mu, U left, it's got to be equal to M up, M charm, M top, with zeros off the diagonal matrix. That's how we want to choose these unitary matrices. So you might say, well, why isn't similarity transformations, which we usually use to diagonalize things, why don't they usually have the same thing here and here? Well, if this similarity transformation, that's what it means. It has the same thing. These are two different matrices, completely different in general. And that's because MU is just some arbitrary 3x3 complex matrix. It's not a Hermitian matrix. Uh-oh. The uh-oh wasn't referring to your question. It was what I was going to do next. But anyways, I'll take the question. Up, charm, top, because that UCT, because that's what we call the mass eigenstates. The value of this is pretty small. The value of this is like 1.2 GeV, and the value of this is 175 GeV, where I've done something slightly sleazy in saying that, but I won't admit it to you at this time. And then when we know a little more, you'll see how I was sleazy. And you can throw your pens at me. Well, how do I find these? I know how to find them if it's a Hermitian matrix and I'm diagonalizing, and I learned that, in high school or public school or on your mother's knee, depending on how precocious you were. This is what you do. You form the matrix. You form the following matrices, which are Hermitian: MU, MU dagger, and MU dagger, MU. So let's look at the following. Let's look at U right, MU. So this is a Hermitian matrix, obviously, right? So if I take the dagger of it, I get the same thing. You with me? So I take MU, MU dagger, U right, dagger, and I write. And what should I do? Well, I'll insert between it the identity, which is U left, and then I'll have U left. Oh, I'll put a dagger here. U left. And this one I can write as U. And so this is just the diagonal one. So this matrix UU right is the one that diagonalized this Hermitian matrix by a similarity transformation. And similarly, UU left diagonalizes the one other way around by a similarity transformation. Yeah?
So everything, all the arguments there are U. There are no Vs, right?
There are no.
So
there are no D's for down, you mean?
Oh, sorry, it's all L, all R's, right?
No, it's not all R's. This is R, this is R.
Oh, I see.
But then I insert the identity as this, because this is diagonalized by the one where they're different.
Sorry, so the two U's, one's unitary, one's up.
Yeah, because, yeah, so this denotes the unitary transformation that you make on the right-handed up-type quarks that diagonalizes the up matrix. Similarly, we're going to have to diagonalize the down matrix and the electron matrix, and there'll be a separate U here for left and right, for up, down, electron, or charged lepton. Yes?
Is there equality between the other signs?
Anything else? You got it? Yep.
Could you explain again why we want to make Hermitian matrices? I understand that we couldn't diagonalize Hermitian matrices with unitary matrices, which is convenient, and we don't have Hermitian matrices.
Well, how would we find these things? I'm telling you how you would explicitly find them, given this quantity. By telling you how explicitly I find them, I've also shown you that you can actually diagonalize a general matrix, not just Hermitian, by a biunitary transformation, but different ones on either side. If it's a Hermitian matrix, you can use the same ones on either side. So I taught you some math in the process. Although it's kind of, more like arithmetic than math. Okay? So, okay, one more thing. I want to introduce one more piece of notation. So it's convenient to sort of, if we have up and down left still in the doublet, then in terms of mass eigenstates, it's going to be this U, U left. So now there's an index I that I'm suppressing. The prime denotes the one that's a max eigenstate. D. And then I can take out an overall factor multiplying the doublet. Remember, these things act in flavor space, not in the doublet space. And then I have the doublet left over that's got U left prime, and then a matrix that's U dagger, U left, U D left on D left prime. And it's this combination of matrices that actually will end up being physical. And we're going to go through all this, of course, but this combination is given a name because it's the one that you can measure and experiment the components of, and it's called the CKM matrix, VCKM, that's what we call it, Kabibo Kobayashi Moskawa, that's what the CKM stands for. Okay, so that takes care of going to the mass, what we call going to the mass eigenstate basis, giving mass to the quarks and leptons, and going to the mass eigenstate basis. So if we look around at all the particles we started with, did I manage to give all the fermions mass? That's good coffee. Okay, let me explain something to you. This is a yes or no question. And there's no penalty for the wrong answer. And there's a cash reward for the right answer.
No.
So make a fast judgment, give it your best shot, and shout it out.
No.
We've gotten masses just for the quarks in the top and top. What about the neutrinos?
I like the answer no. But, of course, yours is more precise and correct. So we'll punish the no by throwing two dimes and a nickel. Try to catch all of these. Might be possible. Nah. Oh, sorry. That was awful. I'm never going to pitch for the Dodgers. We haven't given any mass to neutrinos, and that's because we didn't add right-handed neutrinos to the theory. If you add them, we could give masses just like this, exactly like what we did. We'd have new Yukawas in there. Nobody believes that's how neutrinos get mass. We don't know if they don't get mass that way, but nobody believes that they get mass that way. And the reason is that these Yukawas, these Gs, if we had a new right, so if we had a new right, we could have G new right I J. And that would give mass. Ooh. Did I say that again? Ooh. But for right-handed neutrinos, it ends up, if I add them to the table, they don't transform under anything. They have no hypercharge, no SU2, no color. They don't transform under anything. So I could write down one more term. M nu. IJ, new right I conjugate bar. So you have to know about charge conjugation. Did you learn about charge conjugation in field theory?
Would you mind reminding us?
Oh, jeez. I'm not sure I remember the definition. It's something like I gamma naught, it's gamma 2 nu. Dagger. I'd have to look it up. I'm not sure the precise definition. But there is an operation, charge conjugation. It's in Peskin and Schroeder. I might not have this precisely right. It's in Peskin and Schroeder, the definition of charge conjugation. It's an operator that can act on the Hilbert space. It takes particles to antiparticles, and you can figure out how it acts on the fields.
So if we covered Dirac conjugation, would you say that's the same thing?
If you covered what?
Conjugation.
I don't know what that is.
It's taking psi dagger and multiplying with gamma zero.
Oh no, that's forming psi bar from No charge. So if you look at electrodynamics, it has certain discrete symmetries, like it's invariant under parity and time reversal. And it's also invariant under something called charge conjugation. So this is something that's actually easier if you use two component spinners to explain, but anyways. No, I haven't explained this, but in this case, you can actually write down a mass term for the right-handed neutrinos. And what people actually think is that this mass term is very large, so we don't see these. But it does manage to give mass to the light neutrinos if you take the whole matrix together when the Higgs gets it there. But that's a kind of a separate story. It's a little different story than the other one, so I'm going to leave that out. And if I don't come back to it and what I'm doing, hopefully in the next part of the standard model we'll come back to it. Or you can look it up, you know. I can't do everything in the standard model in a short course like this. I'm not going to give you more details here because I'm not going to do this. Okay, so in the remaining minute, what do I have to do next? Well, I got my quarks and leptons in. I got their quantum numbers. I should work out how the W and Z bosons and the photon and the color SU3 bosons couple to the quarks and leptons. Those interactions determine a lot of stuff that we measure. So we got to work out those interactions. That's our next step in our exploration through the standard model. We'll also work out the Higgs coupling. But they're kind of simple to work out the Higgs couplings. Look at this. We'll do it now. So the mass matrices are proportional to V. And all you do is take out that V and replace it by an H, and you got the Higgs couplings. Because this is the only way the Higgs comes into theory. Woohoo! Yes?
So the secant matrix that we wrote down is?
To three.
So. Do they also include the electrons?
No. So right now, because we don't have neutrinos, because we didn't add any right-handed neutrinos, the neutrinos are massless. And so basically, any linear combination of them is a mass eigenstate. So you can just go to it, so the analog of this is 1. You know, so it, yeah. But if they have masses, then there'll be an analogous matrix there, and sometimes it's called the PMNS matrix. I hope I got all the letters right. But yeah, there's a. Any other questions?